In regards to the last question that was asked, I missed the question before that, but the last question, did you turn this off? Yes, you did. Like the game industry really loves to brag about its R&D expenditures, but it's all D basically is the problem, right? So and that actually tends to, it turns out that's actually a problem in industry in general these days. There's a bunch of research about the lack of original research. I think I read an article in the New Yorker just about it the other day. Okay, so like I said, I'm Chris Hecker, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak to you. I actually think I may end up more positive. We'll see. It's gonna be a battle for who has the more positive talk here. I mean, I think that I decided to structure my talk as a wish list because I figured. Although I have published a paper, allowed me to check off the like peer-reviewed paper life goal, and then now I never have to worry about it again. I unsubscribed from the SIGGRAPH mailing list and all this stuff. I really know more about my industry than I do about my discipline than I knew about your discipline. So I'm going to talk about much like Dan, how we consume research and kind of the distillation of a lot of ideas about what would make it more valuable. The disclaimer here is that I'm assuming you care about being relevant to games, and that is not actually a. I don't assume that everyone cares about being relevant to games. I mean, I would love it if you did, because I think games are really interesting, like Dan was saying. But I would also be asleep right now if I were you and I didn't care about being relevant to games. So if you're in this room, I'm just taking this as a baseline axiom of the talk, right? So I'm not going to bother trying to convince you. I'm in games personally because games I feel like are kind of where film was in 1905. It's like basically at the very beginning of this really potentially incredibly powerful art and entertainment medium. Very rarely does a new medium come along that has the potential to be kind of in that pantheon with film and literature and music. Roger Ebert notwithstanding, hopefully eventually, whether it's 100 years from now, it took film, at least 30 years, 17 years, 20 years, depending on how you count when they actually kind of made the transition, Birth of a Nation, 1917, that sort of thing. But so that's why it's exciting to me. But also another part of the disclaimer, I occasionally curse. So really briefly, like games and research have kind of changed their relationship through the ages. It used to be that like no one cared about games in the research community, and we were basically passive consumers. Like we would attend SIGGRAPH as attendees, not really close the loop. Then games, games becoming more relevant to researchers was like the increase in 3D hardware. The fact that computers are fast nowadays, the fact that the kind of generic 3D industry kind of collapsed, and now you're kind of only left with games and some film stuff. There's a whole bunch of different reasons for this, but now there's actually an active feedback loop, and I think these two sessions today are an example of that kind of a request for researchers come and present at GDC, which, like as Dan said, is not a research conference, but we come and kind of do the same thing as we invite them to come. I'm on the advisory board for the GDC, so that's another involvement in the kind of that Mark was mentioning, like kind of like trying to spread make the interchange more powerful. But researchers come to the GDC, they actively submit. They don't necessarily submit original peer review paper research because we're not a peer review. Our review process is very different. It's not based on peer review or anonymous reviewing or anything like that. But there's an active researcher involvement in the GDC and other game conferences, mailing lists, and that sort of thing. And likewise, game developers are much more going to research conferences, interacting with researchers, and so that feedback I think is great. So there's often a kind of like there's a different set of assumptions that both people bring to the table, and so there's often miscommunications and misunderstandings both in the papers that are delivered and in the requests that are made. So hopefully this talk might help work some of that out. I don't know. So I was thinking, how do you do a talk on research from a game developer's perspective? And And obviously, you should do some research yourself, kind of meta research. And so the primary mode of research these days for everyone in this room, I'm sure, is Twitter. So I tweeted out what looking for people who comment back. There are a lot of game developers that follow me. And as evidence of the kind of interest in this topic and why this is a timely session, I got a lot of responses. And so I did this. I'm going to boil a bunch of these, in fact. I group selected in the directory where I screenshotted all these and just loaded them in. I did not put this one on top for any like political reasons. It just happened to be the one that landed on top. And I don't know if you've ever interacted with PowerPoint with this many animating things, and there's no way I was going to try and change it. And I also asked my peer group, basically the colleagues and people that I interact with, who professional game developers like Dan. And kind of synthesize this plus my own experience as one of those, as Dan would say, call a type one type programmer, someone who's very interested in research, who's active, who can read a technical paper, knows enough math, those kinds of things, is kind of fluent in that community at least, as far as game, relatively speaking, for game developers. And the most important thing when you're targeting, and like I said, the assumption in this talk is that you're trying to target game developers as part of your audience. The most important thing about targeting someone is knowing your audience, right? And so if I were to ask you the question, what is our highest technology priority? Meaning, not what topic to research, but what is the metric, what are the characteristics that's most important of any technology that might be used by game developers, I'm assuming most people instantly in this room went to this. Performance. You think that performance, everyone thinks about game developers as being constantly worried about performance. Oh, squeeze out some cycles here, overlap this over there, just very focused on performance. However, I actually disagree with this to some extent, and I'll talk about for a significant amount of time why that is. So, game technology priorities, as far as I'm concerned, number one is actually robustness. Robustness, Dan mentioned this a couple times in his talks, not using the exact same phrase, terminology, but if you develop an algorithm that works 95% of the time, your algorithm is completely worthless to me, and almost every game developer. It's kind of like an easy way of thinking about this is you think about in different research communities, the OCR research or natural language processing on the recognition side. If I develop a speech recognition algorithm that works 99% of the time, that means in the amount of time I've been talking, it's already failed, 15 times, right? And so when you're trying to present an art and entertainment product to consumers, meaning I'm trying to, much like when you go to a film, you want to have a polished experience that people, or when you're writing a book, you don't want to have typos and grammatical errors. When you're making a game, you have players who are sitting down, who have paid money, to be entertained or to be moved emotionally, or all of the different range of emotions that art and entertainment can do. You can't fail one every 100 frames with a 99% algorithm, right? Because that's failing twice, once every 2 seconds or so. Robustness, I'm going to go into detail about what with the different facets of robustness, but that is in the most important thing. So what's number two? It's got to be performance, right? No. I claim it's simplicity. And again, I'm going to go into each one of these in much more detail. Simplicity, the algorithm has to be simple, understandable, and clear. Finally, number three, performance is very important. Obviously, we're rendering these things at interactive rates. I don't know what the average Pixar render frame time is these days, 20 minutes, something like that. It's for the final renders. I mean, we are doing, a minimum of 30 hertz, you have very few milliseconds in which to get your images rendered, to get your physics simulated, to get your behavior AIs ticked. All of these things have to happen, your sound propagation, all of that. Obviously, any one of these three can be a showstopper. I'm not trying to say that performance is not important. Like, if you don't meet certain minimum performance bars, you're dead in the water. I'm saying that the focus should be on robustness first, because it's more important. than performance. Performance is optimizable. Performance you can make incremental improvements on. Robustness is sometimes inherent in the way the algorithm works, and so you need to really focus on that. So now let's talk about each one of these individual. Well, so it's important to point out something about technology, and this has actually changed over time in the game industry. And this is one of the key differentiators between the goals of a researcher who might be researching topics that are exactly the same in the same area as a programmer at a game developer at a game development company. You know, a senior programmer who's doing quote unquote original research at a game company. For the former, the technology is an end, right? The goal for an academic researcher is to get papers published and to have that paper referenced and that stuff, you know, the material used to teach students to do all of the things that the academy is there for. The goal for a game developer is the technology needs to meet the goals of creating the entertainment experience for the player, right? So these are very different goals. It used to be that technology was more an end, back in the Doom days, for example, where, you know, a really cool rendering algorithm was a game, basically. I mean, that's no longer true, and that hasn't been true for 5 or 10 years. Things that go into the highest end games nowadays, rendering is a small part of them. It's obviously very important. Like, I'm not trying to downgrade the importance of graphics, say, over physics or things like that. But the entertainment experience, the game design, all of these things, the technology is a means to get that stuff up there. Those are the ends. All right. So robustness. Why is robustness so important? Well, interactivity forces us to make robustness the highest priority. Unlike a film where you can kind of build this Potemkin village, a bunch of facades, because you know exactly where the shot is going to be, you know exactly you know the parameters are going to go into it. It's never going to change. We have are in, for the majority of interesting games, the high-end games that you're interested in having your work used in. I mean, they're deeply interactive. You can walk around things. You can see them from different angles. The time of day is changing. All of these things are happening. The player can get right up next to them or far away. All of these things have to, all this interactivity, this ability of the player to feedback into the system and the system having to cope with and react to the player's inputs, forces a level of robustness that most old style graphics algorithms didn't need. You just run the batch again when it crashed. You come in the morning, it didn't work, you just rerun it, you know, with a couple different parameters. That doesn't work on the player's you know, PS3. Okay, so let's talk about the different kinds of robustness. And there are actually a lot of different kinds, and I don't think I'm even getting them, going to get them all on this slide, but I'm going to give you an idea of how we think about the different characteristics. So an obvious one is edge cases. This is the kind of 95-5 thing, right? So what cases does your algorithm work and where doesn't it work? Are there things like if I look at it too close, does it not work? You know, if I look at it too far, is it alias? Like, what are the cases? Separate from that, distinct from that, obviously these are all related, failure modes. When it starts to fail, how does it fail? Does it crash my computer? Does the quality degrade? Like, there are a lot of different ways for algorithms to fail. Does the performance go through the floor? Does it start throwing away geometry? Who knows? I mean, it's a completely different thing than an edge case, right? Is it graceful failure? Is it catastrophic, et cetera? Are there downsides to the algorithm? This is separate from these other two. You know, if it requires me to, or if a side effect of this algorithm is that I have to have some other set of lighting equations in play, things like that, and I talk about dependencies more on the simplicity side, but what are the downsides? Are the parameters, so most algorithms have parameters, and you should have parameters. This is kind of gets to the art direction thing, which I'll talk about a little bit, that Dan also talked about. Are the parameters simply connected? I mean, in a topological sense. If I've got two sets of parameters, can I interpolate between them and all valid interpolants in between there are actual valid inputs to the algorithm, or does the thing totally just fail right in the middle for no reason, you know, because there's a giant hole in the parameter space? Obviously, you want simply connected parameters if you can do it. If not, the paper should talk about this stuff. In fact, and the final thing on this slide, negative results. What else did you try that didn't work? This is actually a pretty controversial topic right now in the medical community, where research actually really, I mean, like, we're doing games, it's art and entertainment, you guys are doing art and entertainment research, like, who really cares at the end of the day? The medical people, like, are killing people or not killing people, right? And they've actually, there's a movement in the past, it's 5 or 6 years, about the importance of negative results, because it's very difficult, and I totally empathize. I mean, now that I've had a paper published, I can see that, and I talk about this in a minute, I can see from a little bit from the inside, like, publishing negative results, no one wants to publish negative results, right? Yet negative results are incredibly powerful and incredibly important. And so there's a new journal, I believe it's called my phone talking to the. There's a journal coming out in the medical community called the Journal of Negative Results, I think. Basically, it's related to there's the Public Library of Science, because it's so important. There's so much I'm not even going to use the word, it's not even evil or conspiratorial. There's just an inherent bias against publishing negative results, and that they've shown, there's been a bunch of meta research that has shown how much that damage that does in the medical research community. So if you're interested in that, there's a whole bunch of both popular and technical papers about that stuff. And so I think that all of these things, especially the four on the left side, it's very difficult to get these things into your paper. When we did this paper, this is the SIGGRAPH paper from 2008 that we did, and before I wrote this paper, I thought it was just because you guys were all slackers, right? So game developers, traditionally the algorithm is, you look at a paper that someone's recommended to you, or you look through the proceedings or whatever, and then you're like, oh, this is kind of cool. Oh, interesting. I should try and implement this. Okay? And so right now you're kind of going down the path. You start to implement it, and it doesn't work. Like, this is the variant shadow maps thing, right? And then you look at the paper, you're reading this paper, and you're reading it over and over and over again, and you're like, the reasons it's not working for you aren't covered in the paper at all. Okay? And you go on the web, and you see other people are still having this problem. You're like, how did this paper get published? It just doesn't work as implemented or as published. And that was basically. At that point, you're like, these fucking researchers, right? And you just think that that's just like they're trying to cover up the badness. But what I realize now is it's not your fault. It's the peer review process's fault. When we wrote this paper, this paper came in at 11 pages at the end, which is apparently like near the limit of how long you can get it. I had to cut 6 or 8 pages worth of stuff out. They forced me to do it in order to publish it. Those 6 or 8 pages had a whole bunch of edge cases and a whole bunch of bad negative results and a bunch of stuff we tried and a bunch of stuff that they were more interested in parsimony than in having that stuff included in the paper, right? And so this is just an inherent problem with the process that you guys. That is like the bread and butter for you guys. The peer review process, and probably after you've done more, I mean, this is my first paper, so I had no idea what I was doing. So probably, I would assume the more experienced among you don't even bother putting that in the next draft, because you know it's just all going to get cut, right? So this needs to change. This is a huge issue with people trying to implement your papers. Especially on robustness, which is our hugest issue. So I don't know how to change this. I don't know whether it's having supplemental materials. Now that everything's coming on a USB drive, page count does not matter, right? Like, I mean, it was ironic because I had to cut, I mean, I cut to the bone of this paper, and it's a really long paper. And I get the proceedings, and SIGGRAPH is still, printed in the phone book proceedings. I get the proceedings, and because they decided to print first pages all on the right, and they cut me down to 11 pages, there was a whole blank page. To make, and I was just like, "Fuck you!" Like, and like, I'm sure the typesetting people didn't talk to the people who were in the peer review and the blah blah blah. But the point is, like, I mean, that penalized in someone trying to learn from this paper, right? So I have a whole separate web page where I talk about a bunch of stuff that went into this paper that got cut. So yeah. So robustness, incredibly important. Simplicity, what I claim is the second most important thing. Here is a picture of game development you want to keep in your head. Okay? This is me, the game developer. This camel is the game. That is a lot of straw. This is you coming up from behind going, I've got this piece of straw. You could just put it right there on top. Like, this is just a one piece of straw, no problem, right? You have to understand that inherent in art and entertainment is this concept of that we are always just at the edge of about to fail. Right? We are not doing our jobs correctly if we are not. Because if we aren't just about to fail but not failing, we could have made the game cooler. Right? So we are right at that edge of systemic complexity, of complete and utter collapse. And you're asking us to like do this cool little thing where you haven't thought about that system, that systemic. The guy who's walking up with a piece of straw is ignoring the fact that that camel is barely able to walk as it stands, right? So this is the model you should keep in your head when you're thinking about all of these razors of simplicity I'm about to talk about in the next slide, where you're like, oh, that shouldn't matter. My thing's really cool. This actually gets to the whole like, in some sense, to the whole how hard is it, one of the second question I think was how hard it is to change an existing system. And this is where you often hear when people are trying to get new things adopted in an area where you have that 10x number, like something has to be 10x better to make any difference, because the cost, the subtle, almost the very difficult to describe cost of systemic complexity makes it so that if you're not going to get 10x, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for 2x. You could give something twice as good, and I will not implement it because it would break the camel's back. Okay, so simplicity. Here I interviewed for part of this, my rock climbing partner is named Ocean Quigley. He's a an art director and a creative director at Maxis. Has been there for 20 years. He's very excellent, career art director or game developer. Very technical, very creative. He's awesome. And we were talking about simplicity as one of the most important things. And he said even crudeness is a positive. Like if two sticks and a rock will do it, great. Right, the elegant, amazing Byzantine like algorithm like does not care. In fact, scares him away from telling people to investigate research. And Dan talked about this one, the first one. You have to make your algorithm explainable to artists. Now that doesn't mean, I don't mean you have to be able to explain, integrating over the whatever to artists at the mathematical level. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the concept of what it's going to do, how it works, what its inputs are, what its outputs are, how it's tunable, all of these things. Artists are in the loop, whether you like it or not. This is why purely procedural algorithms fail all the time, like are just never adopted. You want artists in the loop. You want, in fact, one of the things that what I claimed as one of the contributions of the Spore paper was what we did was we did a procedural animation system with the artist complete. The animator was right in the middle of the loop, and I implored in the paper people to investigate other algorithms, other solutions to research problems by having artists in the loop. In fact, there's a talk that's on my website that I did at the GDC a few years ago that's called Structure versus Style. And my philosophy here is this is how I realized after solving a number of hard problems in the game industry over the past 20 years, that most of the really effective solutions that I saw other people do and that I figured out myself have a structure versus style decomposition. Meaning you've got structure where the computer can reason about it, the math people that you can actually like grind on it with a CPU. And style, it has inputs for having a human, the part that the computer's weakest at, the human inputting style into the thing. And you see this occasionally in SIGGRAPH papers, but you want much more of that kind of like putting an artist in the loop. So explainable artists is one way of talking about that. So this means as few parameters as possible. This showed up on Dan's slides. Dan and I did not do anything except for share our talk titles before this. So any overlaps are obviously must be true. scientifically proven. So very few parameters, as few as possible. It's great that your model is massively parameterizable, but the more parameters you have, the higher dimensional, you get this cursive dimensionality thing going, and you start to lose simply your parameter space is no longer simply connected often because the parameters, it's just hard to keep that much stuff basically topologically a sphere, if you know what I mean. So intuitive output. If I this is a good way of thinking about this is numerical analysis with forward and backward error propagation. Like I need to be able to make small continuous changes in the input and have the output change in small continuous ways. If I make a small continuous change in the input and the output like goes completely from like a dark moody shadow thing to a cell shaded like bright pink thing, like I can't tune that algorithm, right? I can't explain it to an artist. I can't work with it. That gets to this concept, which is different from explaining to artists. The technology needs to be art directable. Someone needs to be able to give someone feedback and let them have a predictive capacity, have them build a predictive model of how to actually tune it based on feedback from a critique. The art director will have a meeting with all the artists and the producers and the designers and whatever, the graphics programmers, and they'll say, okay, this thing's too blue. And they have to be able to go like, all right, here's what we're going to do to make it not as blue. Like, if your algorithm doesn't have that predictability, like, it's useless. Dan talked about this a lot. There's very little understanding outside the game industry of how complicated game pipelines are now. They're incredibly 20-stage pipelines with three modeling tools, five scripting languages. This is not like an exaggeration for effect. This is like the reality of every day working on a game, right? You've got the Python thing that feeds into the Mel thing, but then we have this Perl script that does this other thing, and we've got JavaScript now because we run into a web browser and it was just running, WebKit, which is embedded inside a C# program. I mean, it's just insanity because it's, I mean, and it's spit and baling wire and it barely holds together. It's the camel with the straw. But it is so complicated to get these various things to talk to each other that we just try and get it to work any way possible. And it is it that because the user, the player, will not see it, it can be as nasty as it needs to be to not destroy the project, right? Like it can't destroy the project, but it doesn't have to be any much better than that. Tools, it's hard to hire really good tools programmers. It's hard to find people who really want to work on the pipeline. You want to apply the smartest minds. But they want to work on the stuff that the end user sees. Most people are in the game industry because they want people to play the games they make. So pipeline integration is massively important. I'm going to talk about that here now. So dependencies, an aspect of simplicity is what kind of dependencies does your algorithm have? Now this is obvious like from a code perspective, right? Like do I need an SVD solver to run your algorithm? All right, that matters, right? You need to be clear, here's stuff that I need to make this algorithm work, right? Is it a 2x2 SVD solver, in which case, hey, it's five lines of code and I'm done. Or no, it's an n x n SVD solver, right? Pre-processing, does your algorithm require a huge pre-processing step or any pre-processing or whatsoever? Or markup, does a human have to touch the data before it goes into the algorithm or is it totally automatable? If it's totally quote unquote, totally automatable or totally automatic according to a researcher versus a tech artist who's seen the kind of garbage that will come out of Maya from an artist who wanted to make something look good, there's a wide gulf between the idea of being able to automate based on those two data sets. Like, does it work on non-manifold geometry? Does it work with free-floating vertices sitting in space with no edges connected to them? I mean, there's a billion things. Does it work if there's five textures applied when you're supposed to only have two? Like, how does it deal with that? Does it fail catastrophically? Does it gracefully degrade? Is it possible to even tell you why it failed? Like, if you often, like a lot of these advanced language, computer languages, I mean, it's a different field, but in computer science, like a huge part of making a compiler is actually of making a real compiler that works for real tasks is error reporting, right? Because the naive ways of doing parsers and code generation don't actually keep enough information around to actually report errors that make any sense to people. You have the exact same problem with algorithms that in a deep pipeline, right? Why did it fail? I have no idea, right? Order dependencies. Do I have to sort front to back? What if I was already sorting back to front? Like, do I have to do another pass? Like, all of these things matter. Like, these are pieces of straw on that giant system, and the camel is like, but be upfront about what you require and try and require as little as possible. You want to be as modular as possible. Compatibility, and I mean this in every possible way. What if I'm using YCRCB? Like, does your algorithm work anymore? Is it linear gamma? Like, what? I mean, do I have to like convert all my textures before I feed them to your algorithm? What is its compatibility along the inputs, the outputs, how it fits into the overall structure? Very little thought is given to a lot of this stuff, it seems like, because you're and then but these are things that are showstoppers because we just don't have the capacity to change the entire, unless you're providing the 10x solution, and 10x is a lot. If I was 10 times taller, I mean, imagine, I mean, it's a lot, right? Like, people don't understand how big of a delta 10x is. And so people often don't understand how much better your algorithm needs to be if you're going to jerk me around, right? I'm willing to be jerked around for like the most amazing algorithm in the entire world, but it had better be the most amazing algorithm in the entire world. Okay, finally we come to performance. It's kind of the old, game developers only care about performance thing. I'm just gonna not spend too much time here, but Here, one of the most important things that computer scientists tend to not understand is the constant is really fucking important. Okay? It matters more than the variable sometimes, depending on your data set size, right? I try and beat this into every computer scientist I ever meet. It matters a lot, especially when to the lengths we're willing to go to reduce the constant. I mean, putting something in assembly language is only optimizing the constant, right? We all know that. Yet it is a huge way of getting performance. So it's the old thing of like, oh, the linear algorithm actually turns out to be faster on today's cache architectures than the fancy hierarchical one. Like things like that, but there's 50 examples of that kind of thing, of different ways that the quote unquote non-intuitive algorithmic complexity result, but the performance is not dependent only on the algorithmic complexity. The constant matters a lot. Please report things in milliseconds, not frames per second. Frames per second is almost a useless number. Like, I don't know what your stupid, glut test app is doing to, I mean, who cares? I want to know for the chunk of the algorithm that I'm interested in, how many milliseconds on what CPU architecture, how many threads are you using? That allows me to project, okay, no, you're crack smoking, or hey, this is possible maybe, right? Frames per second doesn't, I mean, it sounds great. It's a 20 frame per second algorithm, but that doesn't mean anything without so much more context than just reporting it in milliseconds. Some of the advice, wish list stuff I have in this talk is giant, really hard systemic things to change. And some of it is like, just report the fucking results in milliseconds, okay? Worst case versus average case. Everybody loves to optimize for average case. It is completely useless to optimize for average case in an interactive system. You have to optimize for worst case. If once out of every 100 frames, you take 400 milliseconds to do something, I can't use your algorithm. Right? But I was only taking 1 millisecond the rest of the time, and let's say 100 times four, it's like, oh, I'm running at 4 milliseconds. No, you're not. Like, you're running at 400 milliseconds as far as the user is concerned. Okay? You hick every time, and I can't do that. So optimize for worst case. It gets to robustness. This is kind of performance robustness, robustosity. You need to understand that everything's about parallelism now, right? Like lots of cores, lots of vector, streaming vector, blah, 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 GPU, whatever. Most interesting problems are not embarrassingly parallel. It's great that we discovered these set of embarrassingly parallel algorithms, rah, rah, rah. But grinding on giant bags of floating point numbers with total homogeneous code is fine, but it's just not that hard. We know how to do that. Task parallelism, grinding on heterogeneous data that is not that is hard to lay out in a structured arrays format, things like this. These are important considerations when you're talking about performance. So you need to think through this stuff. You need to understand what an SPU is and why it's different from a GPU, right? Like, what are the differences here? How much, things are. Once you lift above the basic parallelism 101, data parallelism, things aren't embarrassingly parallel anymore. You need to use real comparisons when you're doing so everybody's got the like, you're at blah blah blah, here's my paper, the performance section. And everybody skips right to the performance section just to see if you have a clue, right? It's not so much because it's the most important thing, it's just like, okay, let me just at least give it I can triage this paper to see if this person has any idea. You have to compare against real algorithms that are practically used. You can't just set up your little test case that makes your paper look good and have this confirmation bias of like, hey, look, my thing is better than this other algorithm. What's the algorithm actually used to solve that problem in practice? What's the implementation of that algorithm? If you're comparing, some GPGPU thing you used, and I totally agree with Dan that GPGPU is way, I mean, we need the GPU for the graphics part. Like, the general purpose part is not going to come for a very long time. In fact, you're more likely to just use the main cores for that. So, but the implementation, we're willing to split an algorithm between the GPU and the SPUs and grind it out and like write assembly language to like have them both processing at the same time, and they're DMAing back and forth and whatever. If you're not comparing against an algorithm that's doing that, you're not doing a valid implementation, you're not doing a valid performance comparison. You need to understand the lengths that we will go to which we will go to actually get an algorithm fast, and this gets to the constant optimization. You can't just compare it, so the example that somebody that one of my colleagues said when we were brainstorming this talk was if you show an algorithm that takes 20 milliseconds, and I'm giving you the benefit of that, you're reporting in milliseconds now. If you show an algorithm that takes 20 milliseconds and how favorable that is over the 30 millisecond algorithm, but you were clueless that we actually use an algorithm that takes 2 milliseconds to accomplish that same task, then your paper is useless, right? So you need to understand what's going on and what implementations we're using to solve a given problem. Real comparisons, are the inputs you're using for your test cases actually real? Compared, like, are you letting the camera get as close as you could get in? If you know, let's say you've got some new, you know, facade map, normal map, offset, blah blah blah, shading, ambient occlusion, whatever, right? Can I walk straight up to it or not? If you don't in your test cases, let me walk straight up to it. Yet I'm expected to do it in an open world game on the streets of New York. I mean, it's not a valid performance comparison. Are you using it in real scenes? Are you actually running it on the number of polygons that are like what we're doing? This is not just size or scalability. It's also like kind of the flavor of the scene. Like, is it how much depth complexity does it have? Is it very occluded? Like, you know, all of these things. Are most of the pixels in the distance? Are most of the pixels in the foreground? You know, all of these things matter. Working set sizes, this is the obvious one, like, are you running your algorithm on the number of objects you would run your algorithm on if it was actually going to be in a game? And so this is a kind of a three-slide trip into what I mean by real data. This is not a video game. Okay? This is a modern video game, running at 60 hertz on a $300 piece of hardware, right? Similarly, this. Do you know how many people touched the pixels that got up on the screen on these things? Like, there was 30 artists, there were 10, 5 programmers, there were 15 scripters, there were like 3 game designers, a producer, art directors, like an animation art director, a shader director, an effects director. Like, a lot of people went into making this scene, right? There's near field, there's far field, there's like fog models happening, atmospherics, shading, like, you know, ambient occlusion, all of this stuff. This is real data. I don't care whether you can do anything on the Stanford Buddha or the bunny rabbit, right? They're just the teapot in today's, you know, in today's SIGGRAPH papers. Okay. Yes, we want source code. Here's the interesting thing about source code. People think of source code as kind of like it's kind of like the constant, like it's an implementation detail. It's like the math is the pure thing. And I'm a huge fan of math. I love math. You know, the paper is supposedly more rigorous than the source code, which has to have all these trade-offs. But the actual better way to think about it, and this is the way game developers, in some sense, and I'm not talking about like the tier 3 game developers. I'm talking about the tier 1 game developers, like the senior, you know, people at these companies. The source code is actually more rigorous than the paper is, because the source code has to work. Right? You can't cut the edge cases out of the source code, right, just to make a page count. Like, if your source code, if you provide source code a demo that I can look at and play with, like, that actually is rigor, okay? You need to understand that the cost to verify that a paper actually works is prohibitively high. We just don't even bother 99.99999% of the time, okay? First, you have this small fraction of papers that are even relevant. Right, to games. I mean, due to some of the stuff I've been talking about here, just due to the fact that like each game has a subset of like, you know, I'm doing tune shading and he's not, and so I don't need the shadow algorithm. But you know, that's just a natural thing. There's just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the world, and that's a great thing. I have to pick and choose. Some small set is even relevant to me. And then sadly, and this is due to brutal, bloody experience, a small fraction of the ones that are relevant even work once you type them in. So source code avoids this problem. It allows me to evaluate a paper quickly. You've got this problem, and this is kind of teasing about the Stanford Buddha thing, but like the object in the center of the screen, even source code that just does the single object in the center of the screen with the Stanford Buddha is better than no source code at all. Obviously something that's in a more of a real environment, the closer you can get. Now, you don't have 30 artists and like 5 animators and all this to do that. So I can understand that, but any source code that demos the algorithm is a huge boon to getting your paper even evaluated. And that's what the first step is, to get someone to even think about using it, right? The screenshots in the paper do that first. And then you're like, oh, well, let me look at like how this integrates. And like, if I can actually run it and get a picture of it, it's huge. And not just because I'm lazy. Like, I'm not going to use your source code, almost certainly, right? You're probably not as good a programmer as I am, and that's fine. It's not your job to be that good. But I need to be able to see what I need to be able to test it with my data sets. I need to be able to see what goes into to making it work. I need to be able to see whether it's robust. If I walk right up to it and the program crashes, I'm going to look at why. Is it just a dumb programming error? I don't care about those. Go, be a crappy programmer. That's totally cool. But is it because the algorithm like looped endlessly? Hey, then I'm starting to like, oh, there's a lot of epsilons in this algorithm. I don't know, what's this 0.001 like here? Is that scale independent? Like, if I'm feet versus meters, does that do I have to retune that? What, So source code's a huge thing. So really briefly, this is not as concrete as Dan's slide about this was. This is just some like caveats about areas that you might do research in. So the very first thing is avoid looking for solutions to problems. And you do this by talking to game developers. It would be really cool if you guys made games in your spare time. Like lots of people are making indie games nowadays. It's like, it's not that hard. It's kind of interesting. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But talk, you should at least cultivate friendships with game developers or professional relationships. I actually had some slides here, ironically, that I cut about progressive meshes. not to beat up on Hughes because I worked at Microsoft with him, but like it is the seminal poster child for paper that has proven to be basically completely useless and yet is one of the most referenced papers in the history. In fact, the only time I've ever done any done reviews for SIGGRAPH, I was invited to do, I was in one of the loops years before I had a couple years before I had the paper published myself. The paper I reviewed was the texturing progressive meshes paper, and I said, I mean, this is all fine, but like no one uses this. Like I don't understand why there's three progressive mesh papers every year in SIGGRAPH for the past 5 years. I don't understand. It's just like here's this is not going to work for these five reasons. No one cares about trying the level of granularity of level of detail. It's completely solving a problem that's not actually needed to be solved. Like there's it doesn't et cetera. And like just totally ignored. Like there's no, I got no feedback whatsoever that was a valuable piece of feedback in the review process at all. You want to solve problems that need solving. And I don't mean you want to chase, you're not, I'm not saying you should be an outsource tech team for games. That's not at all what I'm saying. But there's a set of problems that we have no idea how to solve that we really, like order independent transparency. Like please, for the love of God, figure out an order independent transparency algorithm, okay? Like that would revolutionize everything, right? And there are some, but like, wow, they're bad. And there's a bunch of big, hard problems like that. Lighting models, like, I mean, just there's a ton of stuff that would be problems looking for solutions, not the inverse. Okay, so graphics, it has to integrate well. That's kind of the overall thing. That means robust, simple, performant, all of these things. Like, you have to understand that the Stanford Buddha sitting in the middle of the screen rotating is not, you're not done yet, right? AI, the fundamental flaw that people researching AI for games do is they don't understand that AI is game design. If you are not, I gave a talk at Stanford late last year that I'm going to put on my website that was for the AIAIS conference, which is the kind of academic game research conference, this for AI. And I basically said you have to make games. Like you cannot black or white box AI research and have it be at all useful. You have to make a game. You can't just like, and not a game where you like force your grad students to play it for 30 minutes and then they give you glowing reviews of it. Like it's a game you put up and I can see and I can play it and I say like, yes, this thing does not suck. Because AI is really on the art side of the craft art dichotomy in game development. So if you want to bite off, AI is actually, we need way more AI research than we do graphics research. So graphics is way easier to research. But if you're going to do AI research, you're really diving deep into the game side of games. So you need to think about that. If you're going to do animation, you need to understand that interactivity is king. If you do an algorithm that is like an offline algorithm that does not respond to me hitting left on the stick and it does not respond in a pleasing number of milliseconds, it's completely useless. Like, sure, I could use it for my cutscenes, but I'm just going to do those in Maya anyway, or in Engine. What it does, I don't care about that problem. So other people will solve that problem for me. I need algorithms that allow me to blend between animations quickly with where the feet don't slip and where the quality is good. So interactivity, if you're doing animation research, you have to understand interactivity and what that means in terms of, like you need to understand what the difference between 10 milliseconds and 5 milliseconds feels like on the stick. Like you need to understand that there's latency in modern HDTVs. Do you know this? Like, do you know how much they're adding? Why is there a game mode on modern HDTVs? Things like that matter for things that are tied into interactivity, and animation is the key one that's tied into interactivity. If AI is the kind of game design, then is at the game design level. Interactivity is at the controller level, or animation's happening at the controller level. So you need to understand that. My personal pet thing that is perceptual models and metrics. I wish there was more research. You've started to see it over the past 5 or 10 years using perceptual models, as opposed to just like diffing the image or PSNR or whatever. Like, I think of perceptual models as, I mean, you know, there's this kind of, and you kind of heard it a little bit early. Like, there's this like research versus programming kind of idea of like, oh, they just hack, or oh, they're just like living in theory. But like, what's interesting to me is perceptual models actually bridge the gap. They formalize hacks. They allow you to say, this is what's important and this doesn't matter. Why? You know, in games, I might, like in the Doom days, might have just like, you know, left shifted some pixel value and it looked great, and so I kept it. A perceptual model will actually tell me why that looked better. Right? And so that's actually a nice bridge between the two, between the two disciplines. Okay, here's a bag of miscellaneous stuff. Patents, don't if you want your research used. It's that simple, basically. If you must patent things, disclose it at the very beginning so I can not read your paper. Right? Because the way the patent system is so fucked in this country, I need to not read your paper, right? And so that's just the way it is. So I think that this actually should be a requirement. ACM should require this. Like, there should be the abstract, any IP disclosure, then the paper. Put your paper online. Paywalls suck. People who live in academia think that it's easy to get a company to buy 300 different paywall subscriptions. If you're doing cutting edge game research, it is not just the ACM where you end up going. It is, you're on the Elsevier's website, and then you're in, like, you know, five levels deep in some chemistry website, and you can't get any of these fucking papers, and you're furious. Like, during Spore, I spent $30 on a paper at 3 a.m. one night. And I was just like, I don't have, you know, usually what I do is I have a bunch of academic friends and I send them email. I'm like, can you give me this paper? But hey, it was 3 a.m. and I needed to look at this paper. Of course, the paper, because of the, like, you know, relevance and then works, like, was totally irrelevant. So I just wasted $30 of my own money. But like, I worked at Electronic Arts at the time, like the largest game company in the world, and there was just no way for me to get this paper, right? Without having a professor colleague steal it for me, but they were asleep. So put your paper online. Now, for graphics researchers, this is actually not a big problem. So, because almost everybody, you know, the SIGGRAPH, I mean, the ACM is in some sense, really fucking this up, like the whole thing with the whole SIGGRAPH pre-paper thing last year. Hopefully the new board will like actually make some progress on that. But what the bigger problem is, like, chemistry, physics, all of your colleagues in other departments that you might work with on a paper, very few of those papers are available anywhere. Your old papers are often not available. Have a grad student scan all your old papers and put them up, or just download them from the ACM's website and throw them on your website. You're allowed to do that, even though they horribly make you sign all your IP over, copyright over. Like, just do that. Suck all your old Adobe Type 3 font crappy, like, Alias papers over and just throw them up on your website. Like, it's the right thing, and it will increase the usage of your work and make a lot of industry people very happy. Publish the negative results. This is the thing I was talking about. If you can't get them into the paper, put them on the website. Say, we tried this algorithm, this algorithm, this algorithm. Spend time talking about that. It's really important. It saves people time. It helps lend credibility to the robustness. Answer emails. Oftentimes, we'll send email to the person on the paper when we're in that evaluation phase. Do I even want to, like, walk over the cliff of trying this? No response. Play games. You need to understand the difference between those screenshots I was showing. Like, what is going on in games nowadays? I don't mean you have to need to finish games. Most games are crap. Like, let's be clear. But you need to at least be comfortable, like, with a controller, understanding what latency feels like, understanding what lighting models are using, what, you know, how far we are right now or how far we aren't. It will give you a ton of research ideas too. Like, oh wow, that shadow just looks like crap. I could do something about that. Lighting models, etc. That's my job.
we've run a little bit over, but I think we have time for a couple questions because the coffee break is a good section. So.
Sure.
So I have a question on your paywall statements, et cetera.
Okay.
Mostly, I love your talk, but there's a kind of structural problem in our industry that I want your feedback on.
Okay.
So an academic gets almost no funding from the government.
Right.
So you want them to report their frames in milliseconds so that it's relevant to their work. You don't want them to patent their stuff.
Yes.
You don't give research grants to academics for the most part.
Yeah, I mean.
And you don't even want to fund their.
Yeah.
Finally, you know, in the ecosystem, presumably the academics ought to be looking 5 years out, which means their millisecond report should be like 1,000.
That's fine. No, let me. There's a bunch of different layers to that question. Or did you have more, or did you want to?
Well, and my bottom line is, I feel like what's missing here is research labs and data.
Right. Okay. So let me address a few. There's a few different. I mean, it's all related, but a few different like opinions that will happen there. Okay, so number one, I'm fine with 1,000 milliseconds. I'm not saying it has to take 2 milliseconds. I'm saying report it in a way that I can make predictions about. Okay, so I'm saying be clear. I agree. I actually wish there was more. I am saddened by the fact that academic research labs look a lot like commercial research labs nowadays. They're very short term. They're very like, how do I get grants for this year? There's very little original, you know, like really blue sky research going on. That actually saddens me because the industry is not going to do that stuff. You guys are the only guys who are going to do that stuff. I understand that funding academic research, I mean, I don't understand it at a deep level, but I, you know, have enough friends in the academic community. I understand that it's a giant pain in the ass nowadays, and you're expected to spin off a startup company every 3 months with your research, and I think that's a huge shame. I think if you can't do original research at universities, we're fucked. I don't know what to say about that. It's not something like, there's no way Electronic Arts is ever going to fund a 10-year research project with no strings attached. It's just not, that's just not the way game industry thinks right now. I don't know if the film industry does that. I assume they don't, but I wish they would. I think that's a huge problem. I think that there needs to be a change in the way academic research works because the way that it's funded now, I just don't. I mean, I'm depressed every time I look at what people are working on because it just seems so short term. I want the 1,000 millisecond algorithm that is so mind-blowingly amazing that I'm willing to spend 6 months and 3 programmers trying to get it fast. You know, of course. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I stands for interactive here, right? Like, so I think there's some baseline, but I mean, so I'm not speaking so much about this conference in particular. I'm talking about the entire realm of academic entertainment relevant research, right? There is very little of that 10-year stuff going on. Now, there's an old truism in games that we used to look at basically, we used to be like a 5-year behind, like, you know, when we were in the consuming phase of research. Now we read a lot more cutting edge stuff, or, you know, where cutting edge is defined as the papers published that year. Unfortunately, that's not so much because our hardware is so fast that now it's all your amazing, the research hasn't changed and we're now caught up. It's more because like a lot of the research is like about what can happen right now, which I think is, you obviously want some of that, and that is a way of being more relevant, but there's a separate thing that's not related to this rant, which is that thing about, like, I do want more of that, like, long-term research. I think it's a shame that more of that doesn't happen. Like, there's again, this is kind of related to the negative results stuff. There's a lot of research about research nowadays and how little R there is in the R&D community. Yeah, there was somebody else before you. Hold on a second. Yeah.
You want us to use real data. Is your company providing any real data that you
use? I mean, so I don't actually, I work, I'm indie. You're welcome to source code to my game if you want, but like, but in terms of like, I know that Electronic Arts, which is the company I used to work for, provided all the Sims 2 assets to CMU for some of their AI research and stuff. I think that it's not, my guess is if you get the right person there, it's not that hard to get real data. I don't know, I mean, I could be wrong, but my guess is
we're
like,
NVIDIA, and we have trouble getting data.
Yeah.
Totally wrong.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Manny's comment earlier blew me away. I have not seen a paper published for that. usually personal relationships. Like, I'm good friends with the engine programmer.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what I'm saying. You have to cultivate those friendships. I mean, there are situations like The Sims 2 assets to CMU, which is a ton of animated 3,000 polygon models in you know, scripts and whatever. I think it's short-sighted of the industry. I have a ton of criticisms of the industry. Don't worry. Like, so I actually, one thing I didn't recommend, like, there is no research in the industry. It is all D. There is no R. Like, when EA publishes their R&D numbers, it's just D. Like, so, and that's a huge shame as well. Part of the reason they don't fund academic research is because most of it is useless, right? And so they just don't see the return that they want. They don't understand that that's a self-fulfilling prophecy in some sense, but that's going to take a long time to change. So yeah, I mean, as far as getting data out of the game industry, I wish there was more of that. I mean, you know, id open sources all of their games after a certain year period, right? Well, no, but you don't have to digest the entire, Right. Well, a lot of these things, like for taking Quake level, for example, which is not realistic anymore, but at least is more realistic than the Buddha, there are a ton of open source readers for that that'll just give you back a list of triangles. And I mean, there's a give and take here, right? Like, you have to be willing, if you're going to present real results on relevant data, you end up biting off part of the pipeline problem. You're like, how do I get this giant piece of data into my game and into my demo? There's a part of that that you're going to have to do as well, right? I mean, we need to do better at providing the data. That's clear, but that's the thing. If you want to seem to be more relevant, you're going to have to get the half a graduate student to actually, you know, read it in. I don't know how much more you want.
I think we should wrap it up and take our break. I'm sure that Chris will be happy to answer questions during the break as well.
Sure.
So, thanks.